Thursday night, end of the week edition of the Dunktown Basketball Podcast. I promise that we will not spend too much time on the Cavs-Raptors series, although we are contractually obligated to discuss it. And then we also have to discuss Frank Vogel getting hired in Orlando. And we're going to do free agent rankings for the big men, which will be a real interesting crop of players this year. Danny, have your eyes recovered yet from watching the Toronto Raptors play basketball?
Yeah, I mean, it is still basketball, so there's that engagement. At least it's not baseball, which is the sport I grew up watching. But good Lord.
I've become the world's biggest Cavs fan because I just want this series to be over as soon as possible and just not have to deal with the Raptors anymore. I really wanted to like them. I like them as a franchise. I like what they've done as an organization in general. I really appreciate the Canadian fans' passion up there. They probably have one of the top five fan bases in the league from everything that I can tell. But gosh, if they just didn't have DeRozan on the team, maybe I would feel better about it. But also, like, they just have no crispness at all to their offensive execution. They just seem to make dumb mistakes all the time. And obviously Cleveland deserves a ton of credit. Like, this wasn't a terrible Raptors team, and they have played relatively good defense, at least, throughout the playoffs. But man, they just look so completely overmatched.
But how can you root against a team that's starting Louis Scola?
I understood why they did that, I think, because I think the thinking was, number one, to get more out of Patterson and his bench role. They have this weird feeling, which may be true based on the performance, at least in the past. You don't know whether that actually extends to the future, or it could just be random noise, that he plays better off the bench. And then Scola at least provides more intelligence defensively, if not the actual ability to move or jump. And intelligence was the number one thing that they were lacking in the first game. But, I mean, the biggest problem, we can talk about Casey shuffling the deck chairs on the Titanic all we want. And their offense has definitely looked really bad. That's been a problem, too. But they just don't have LeBron James and they don't have Kyrie Irving. Those are by far the two best players in the series so far. And you're going to lose when that happens.
Yeah, James is justifiably getting a lot of attention, but I think Kyrie has looked pretty awesome the last week or so.
Yeah, he has. Some of his finishes, like Van Gundy was gushing over his level of strength on the broadcast, and I was similarly impressed. I mean, some of those plays where he just went right into Biombo, who's a great shot blocker, and just scored over him, you know, knocking back Kyle Lowry, knocking back poor DeMar DeRozan, who just, whenever the game, any sort of a play gets remotely physical, he just shrinks into his little turtle shell. Yeah, and then James, I mean, he looks as spry as I can recall since he's come to Cleveland. That dunk that he had on the fast break, I mean, you know, athleticism isn't all fast break dunks. You know, it's the ability to quickly gather yourself and have some bounce in situations where you have to react. But nonetheless, that was really impressive. I mean, that might have been like the best fast break dunk all year.
Yeah, it's great to see him do that too, because while he isn't in his prime physically, I mean, we're not, I think that the people who get outraged when some say that are discounting how incredible his prime was. He is still a great athlete.
Yeah, to say that he's declined, he is still fantastic, and to not note that he has declined is being disrespectful. Amin made this point about Kobe Bryant, that it's being disrespectful to how good he actually was in his prime, that he was the second best player of all time, and now he is no longer the best player in the league. That necessitates that you're going to have some decline. Although, you know, maybe he will try to stake his claim again to that throne if we see a finals rematch with Curry and the Warriors. And a couple other notes in this game. The Cavs have really been run off the three-point line relatively well by Toronto. It's the one thing that they've actually succeeded in doing. They've held them to 7 out of 21. I mean, the bigger thing being the 21 attempts. In the Atlanta series, are getting up like 30, 40 attempts in a game. You just can't win giving up that number of three-pointers to a great three-point shooting team like this. But they also just couldn't stop it. They gave up 37 free throw attempts. And this would have even been a worse blowout if James hadn't gone 9 out of 17 from the foul line inexplicably. And what do you think they could be? Because I think it all starts, you know, Kyrie's doing what he's doing. He's going to get hot sometimes. He's going to ISO. He's going to make inexplicable plays. But especially as long as he's not shooting threes, you just can deal with that. It's James is the big problem. I mean, he had 11 assists, 11 rebounds, only played 34 minutes in this one, 23 points, extremely efficient, and should have been more efficient if he'd made his free throws. What else can they be doing differently on him? He assisted or scored 20 of their first 22 points in this one.
It's hard. Like, I don't think there are any clear-cut solutions. My general tact with James is to, you know, make sure you keep the center around the basket as much as you can to stop penetration and give him a little bit of space, and then just kind of try to stick it on everybody else as best you can. That creates problems when you have somebody like Kyrie Irving, who's such a good one-on-one player. But I think that's generally what I would do, and the Raptors aren't an exception to that.
Yeah, it's going to be a problem when they can't score and James is getting out in transition.
Yeah, there's nothing you can do there.
Buckets and his fouls, you know, but that's, I mean, you could try to score better. That's not anything specific to him. They are not doing a great job when he is involved in pick and roll going under. Like, you remember that play at the end of the half where James Johnson just didn't go under the screen from JR and LeBron just went right to the basket and got an and one on a pretty weak foul attempt by James Johnson. I don't think James Johnson is the answer. He, even when he was at his athletic peak, which he certainly has grown a bit more corpulent since those days, he was never the most intelligent guy. LeBron is going to beat someone like that. I think one thing they can do is when he is playing the four on the second unit, they are guarding Dellavedova with their point guard. I think they need to guard him with someone like Damari Carroll, bring him back in, and then you can, and they had Patterson finally as the primary matchup against LeBron there. You need to be able to switch that pick and roll. And another aspect of that too is if they're going to do more switching, they need to, and you know, you put the smaller guy on J.R. Smith, or you put him on, which they'll run a pick and roll with him too, or if it's Shumpert with that reserve unit, you could put the smaller guy on him, make them run a pick and roll with Shumpert, and then throw it to Shumpert on the roll. You can just trap that if it's Shumpert, and Shumpert's not going to be the ball handler in pick and roll with James the way Dellavedova is. And then the other thing you got to do is just whoever is bringing the ball up for the Cavs, especially Dellavedova is a pretty slow guy, you need to just pressure the crap out of that guy. And again, this relies on actually scoring on occasion, but make them use as much of the shot clock. Even 2-3 seconds makes a huge difference if you're switching, because then they're going to want to go to the ISO, and if, and then, you know, you want to try to front James if you can, not let him get the ball to the best of your ability. I mean, just anything you can do to sort of slow them down, waste a second or two, get him into a late clock situation. But, you know, this, again, this is all stuff on the margin.
Yeah, it is all stuff in the margins, but I really support the idea of pressuring in that kind of a situation, especially with a guy like Dellavedova who handles it well enough, but he's not going to beat that in that kind of a way. Like, you know, if he gets past the pressure, you're not sitting there like, oh God, this is a definite basket.
Yeah, because that second unit, of course, has been completely destroying the Raptors with Fry at center. They've been putting Biombo in during those times. I think at that point might be a time, and have been playing James Johnson too, and they are low. You know, Biombo just cannot deal with Fry at all, so maybe you even try to put him on Shumpert instead. You know, put a smaller player on Fry and just deal with Shumpert shooting threes, and if he beats you, he beats you. Again, these are very unorthodox solutions necessitated by what is a somewhat intractable problem. I think Patterson should just be on James as much as possible. If you want to post up Kevin Love on Damari Carroll, fine, you know, with the starting unit, but they just cannot deal with those James post-ups. And then they also need better execution on those plays too, because what the strategy was is they're bringing over Biombo to the strong side zone on those post-ups, which you should really do. And they executed that better. And then one of the guys on the weak side was crashing down to take Tristan Thompson, who was hanging out by the rim. And then you've got a 2-on-1 on the backside, and that was very often DeMar DeRozan. And he, you know, basically the way you have to do it is whoever James throws the pass to, you close out to that guy, whether it's your man or not. And then you can have whoever is crashing down on Thompson can get out to the other guy, whichever of those three-point shooters on the weak side the initial pass wasn't to. And there's enough time because there's another pass involved there. That's the hope. But DeRozan just was not able to execute that at all. He just went back to his own man even when the pass wasn't to his man. He just is so bad defensively in pretty much all aspects of the game.
God, you're gonna be so much fun when he gets maxed out by somebody on like July 3rd.
Yeah, I just hope he doesn't end up on the Lakers, because as I've noted with the draft, I was hopeful that they're gonna I was glad that they got the number 2 pick, because on the West Coast the Lakers are one of the few teams that we'll watch, especially because they start at 7:30 instead of 7, so they're frequently the last game on that we're just kind of stuck watching. And if he's on the Lakers, like, they're just going to be, again, pretty much unwatchable, I fear. And they would be fools to get him. He fits in so badly with everyone else who is there. Anything else you thought they could do maybe on offense?
I can't think of anything in particular that I think would really open it up, but because you have the whole negative feedback loops with them that their bad offense is fueling bad defense and vice versa. But I mean, I honestly can't really think of much that they could do outside of, you know, just executing better. But that you can't say like execute better. That's not a strategy.
Yeah, and they could execute better. There are just so many little things we've talked about it ad nauseum with this team that they just, you know, for example, there was one possession where they took 10 seconds. Patrick Patterson started off in the corner. There were two guys set to screen for him near the free throw line, and like three guys were pointing at him that he had to run all the way around those guys, go off the screen, and then set a screen for Kyle Lowry way back on the same side of the floor. And it took him like 10 seconds to actually get over there and start the player. There are other plays where, you know, guys will run to set a screen and the guy just won't go off it quickly enough. He'll just sort of wait there, let the defense recover, and then go off the screen. And it's just, there's no flow, there's no crispness to their execution. And, you know, it's all very station to station. Okay, run this play. Now you guys run this play. Make sure you're standing in the exact right spot. You know, it's just, it's all just like step by step by step. And if step one is messed up, they have no possible counters. And it's just, it's really ugly offensive basketball.
It is.
One thing I would say is that I thought they had the most success that they've had in this series running pick and pop with Patterson guarded by Love. Of course, they took him out of the starting lineup, makes it a little harder to do that. But they got good looks on that. I mean, they scored on their first, when they took that 7-0 lead at the beginning, other people were saying Love's defense was better, and it has been pretty decent. But in that particular time period, I thought that they got good looks, and they went up 7-0 and they got great looks for Patterson nearly every single time out of that action. So I think that's a way to go. Setting more screens for Lowry coming off the ball, especially with Love's man when he is in there, with Fry's man when he's in there, is another way to go. And you just got to hope that Lowry can start hitting his threes. But that's about all I got. You know, I mean, as far as little things that they can start doing. And, you know, their offense has definitely really disappointed me in this series. And although they've still scored way better with Lowry on the floor because things just run better that way, he really just has been bad again, and pretty much has been bad at all times during these playoffs, other than when he was playing against the Miami Heat with no Hassan Whiteside.
Yeah, he that was a nice little bright spot, though. Go Cavs, go.
Well, so this is something I tweeted about that got a few retweets, was that basically after this playoff performance, after really struggling in the last two playoffs before this, that I'm at the point now where despite, you know, no matter what Lowry does in the regular season, you know, unless he like wins MVP or something, which he's not going to, I'm just not really going to trust him to be as good in the playoffs as he has been in the regular season. I think it's getting to the point now where whether it's mental, whether it's due to more intensity, whether it's due to playing better defensive teams, whether it's due to their lack of flow and system offensively where teams are really able to lock in on him, whether it's not being able to deal with a rim protector that well at this stage of his career, whatever it is, I think I'm at the point now where I'm going to conclude that there is something about the playoffs that he does not do well. And I'm not saying that he can't do well in the playoffs, but I'm going to assume even, you know, next year that we're just going to see a drop off from him until I see differently.
And at certain points you can look at that, you know, let's say against the Pacers, they had a very good defensive point guard and they had reliable rim protection. But that ties in with it because the teams that make the playoffs and the teams that advance in the playoffs are going to more often have those pieces because particularly rim protection is conducive to a successful basketball team. So as you get into the playoffs, you should expect opponents to have that. And so I think that's certainly fair. And there are players and there are teams that are better suited for the one-off nature of the regular season. And especially for me, people that can rely on intensity and that can really get up for certain games. Lowry is one of those. He's also a little bit different than some of the point guards that people get into. So I'm totally fine with that interpretation.
The Raptors, we can talk about Cleveland's defense a little bit. Kevin Pelton wrote a nice piece on them today about, you know, should they be considered the favorites with this incredible offense that they've had. But one of the reasons he concluded they aren't quite yet is because their defense had been below average. Now they've played two very good defensive games in a row. The Raptors did shoot, I think, 9 out of 33 from three-point range, which, you know, you would expect them to shoot a little bit better than that. But while Tristan Thompson is not a great rim protector, their strategy was to just switch a lot of stuff and just keep the Raptors out of the paint. At the rim, they shot pretty well, and they actually got there, 12 out of 17. But then in the paint, away from the rim, they only took 5 shots. That's an incredibly low number for an NBA game. And then outside of the paint, 27 two-point attempts, They were 10 out of 27, and then they had those 31 three-point attempts. So they just were not getting effective penetration to where they could get enough shots close to the rim. And they also not getting to the free throw line, only 14 out of 18, and a lot of those were kind of late. So it was they're just not doing a good enough job. They don't have the dynamic athletes on the perimeter to deal with the Cavaliers switching, especially when it's Thompson. And even Love, you know, DeRozan, they were switching Love onto DeRozan, no problem. And DeRozan can't go by Kevin Love. You know, he can get maybe a little bit better of a long two, but with the firepower that the Cavs have, no matter how well you shoot on long twos, you're not keeping up with them.
And what you just got into in the last point is why I don't read too much into these strong performances, is that Toronto doesn't have the personnel good enough to take advantage of it, so they're not really getting tested. So it's always good, you know, a positive thing that is more noise than signal is still positive, but I just don't put as much credence into it.
Yeah, we'll see how their defense looks. I mean, the offense just is completely unstoppable, especially when Fry or Love are at center. They just have no way to deal with them whatsoever. A couple other small things that I noted from this one before we move on. I really enjoy Cleveland setting down screens for either Love or Fry to pop out to the three-point line. A big man, you know, who can just space the floor and stand out at the three-point line and shoot is nice, but when it's a guy who can come off a screen and he has that footwork, or even better, a guy who can pick and pop for three-pointers, which both Love and Fry can, that becomes really, really difficult to deal with, especially when you have a traditional big like Biyombo, who's never practiced, you know, getting through a screen out to the three-point line in his life, you know, which is not his fault. That's not what he's been asked to do, but it's just very, very difficult to deal with. And then another thing, too, is Jeff Van Gundy suggested on the broadcast that he might consider just playing zone on every ATO, and because these coaches are just so efficient at ATOs, and one issue with that is that ATOs are actually the least efficient play out there. I think that it actually favors the defense to kind of slow things down and remind people of what their responsibilities are. But, and maybe zone could even make them less efficient. But then the other problem with that, too, is if they know you're going to play zone, then you can just run a play to combat that zone.
Yeah, in certain contexts, maybe you can do it. But especially against Cleveland, a team that has a lot of capable three-point shooters, I don't think that's a great idea.
Yeah, and Brad Stevens actually very often plays a 2-3 zone. Our friend of the program, who I've never met, but I respect his work, Half Court Hoops on Twitter, does some great videos of certain plays. And so he did a video of all these times that the Celtics have played a 2-3 zone out of a timeout late in games. And it does seem to work pretty well for Stevens. All right, we'll get to those news items with Vogel going to Orlando. But first, our old friends SeatGeek would like me to let you know about their fantastic app. SeatGeek aggregates all the ticket buying sites together, so you don't have to worry that, oh yeah, I went to this site, but I got to check 8 other ones to see whether the prices are cheaper there. It's all at your fingertips in an app, very simple. You don't have to bother with CAPTCHA at all because it's on your phone. You don't have to prove that you're not a robot. They also have a metric called Deal Score that lets you know when it's a good or a bad deal, and that helps with both buying tickets and also selling tickets. If that's what you want to do, you can kind of figure out what a fair price is with some of these. So if you're looking for NBA playoff tickets, SeatGeek is definitely the best place to go. And when you go to checkout, all of the fees will be mentioned up front. It's not like you do all this work to finally select your seats and then all of a sudden it's 30 extra bucks of fees. It's all up front. And then it'll be, as a first-time user, a little bit less than that initial price once you get your $20 rebate, which will be sent to you as you enter the code CAPSPACE, all one word. That lets them know that you came from us. Very important that you enter that, both to get your $20 rebate after you make your purchase, and also so that they will continue to advertise on the show. So the SeatGeek app, use that CAPSPACE code, and you can get some great deals either buying or selling tickets. So would you rather have, going forward, the Orlando job or the Indiana job? Were you Frank Vogel?
I like Indiana's top-end talent better. You do have the uncertainty with Paul George, but I'm a big fan of PG and Miles Turner together.
Yeah, the two things that we've always said that Orlando doesn't have is the guy that looks like he's going to turn into a superstar and someone to protect the rim. And obviously the Pacers have plenty of that. I think he's getting paid a lot more money in Orlando. It's reported as a 4-year, $22 million deal by David Aldridge. And that's the same per year salary that Portland gave Terry Stotts. That's pretty much about the going rate these days. $5 million a year for a coach who has coached before and is relatively successful. And I would gander that that is more than he was making previously in Indiana. And he does have a very talented young roster there. I think that one of the things I really like about Vogel that you have praised on many occasions too is that he does a good job of knowing who to play and who not to play and kind of settling on a rotation and using the right guys.
Yeah, there were a few little things with like CJ Miles and all that kind of stuff, but I think that on the aggregate, he figured out his big man rotation better than a lot of other coaches would have with the unusual inputs that they had this year in Indiana.
Yeah, and even going back to some of those good Pacers teams, 2012 through 2014, where they brought he got a ton out of Lance Stephenson, bringing him in with the bench unit. He played his starters together a ton. That was a very, very formidable unit. You know, David Locke always likes to praise him for that he plays his starters together in a cohesive unit, maybe more than just about any coach in the league, which is definitely, I think, something that more coaches should do, depending on what your talent is. So I think I trust him to do a better job in that regard than Skiles, who was just totally whimsical in his rotations from game to game and kind of yanking all their young players around. I think that he is really going to be on board with growing this franchise. And defensively, I think he certainly has an amazing track record, maybe the best of any coach who is on the market this year other than Tom Thibodeau. And I expect that they will, especially as they get more experience, get more cohesive defensively. And then he may also even choose, I don't know this for sure, to de-emphasize Nikola Vucevic, although we'll have to see, of course, who they end up signing in free agency. But this is a great, great haul for the Magic. Best coach available on the market at this point, I would say. And I think he'll do well there.
Something that I've noticed about this offseason is that a lot of teams not only have upgraded a coach that have made a change, but have also upgraded relative to what I expected them to do. That is definitely true of the last two hires with Jeff Hornacek to the Knicks yesterday and Vogel. They're both upgrades.
Dave Yeager,
yeah,
too,
they're,
right?
They're, all of those guys are upgrades. Luke Walton fits into this group as well. They're upgrades on the prior coach, but they're also better. Like when I was thinking about how the carousel would go, I thought all those teams would do worse than those guys.
Yeah, well, we don't know that for sure. You know, there are plenty of unknown coaching candidates.
Sure.
Dave Yeager was once one of them himself. So was Vogel. So was Luke Walton, even. That may be better than some of these guys who are established. But in terms of guys with a pretty decent track record, I think, yeah, those guys, those franchises all did pretty well. A couple other little smaller notes related to Vogel. It appears, per Mark Spears of ESPN, that Dan Burke and Popeye Jones, who were Vogel's assistants in Indiana, are expected to stay there under new coach Nate McMillan. Dan Burke was lauded by Larry Bird as the architect of the defense, and even to the point where I felt like he was giving Burke credit and saying that the defense wasn't going to fall off, because even if Vogel left, who knows how much you apportion that credit. It's impossible for us to really know without talking to people inside, and even they, it's got to be pretty hard for them to do it. So, but I think that's a good sign for the Pacers that they can continue their defensive identity while hopefully moving to a better offense under McMillan. Not that he necessarily has that track record, but that's the hope at least.
Yeah, it's a nice little thing, and you can understand for assistant coaches who can often travel around so much that their jobs can do that they would want to have some semblance of continuity.
Some smaller housekeeping. Another of those Sacramento Kings who signed a deal with a player option at close to the minimum has opted out. This is Quincy Acey, who actually started for them a fair amount of the year. He's someone who I think can help as an energy forward off the bench, and a guy who maybe we'll talk a little bit more about as we get into the free agent rankings. But I think he can help a team and could have the upside of being a rotation big if he doesn't necessarily have that established track record already on a good team. And then in somewhat sadder news, but totally understandable, it appears that the French, who are the favorite in their qualifying group to get into the Olympics after they lost to Spain at Eurobasket last year, we're hoping to see them. It's kind of looking like a weak Olympics, but now they are going to struggle a little bit because some of their main guys are going to be out. It's been reported Nicola Batum is going to be out, Evan Fournier, Rudy Gobert. I mean, especially the guys who are going to be free agents. Like, the Olympic qualifying tournament starts July 5th, like right during the free agent period, so it really just does not make sense for those guys to be in that.
It is unfortunate. France is one of those teams. I've had a couple of Canadians in my mentions be a little bit happy about it from their own ends because they're in the same qualifying group. But yeah, I was excited about it. The timing was super weird, and to put it during the time when players can't sign contracts is just a bad idea because it's not even about being risk averse. It's about being responsible.
France's loss is actually going to be potentially Canada's gain. They also really disappointed at the tournament in the Americas, losing to, I can't remember if it was Argentina or Mexico, but they, I presume that they're going to have most of their guys. It would be a great step for that nation in Olympic basketball if they're able to make it. And the other teams that they're really going to be fighting to win their qualifying tournament, there's six teams in it. This is actually going to take place in Manila. Turkey, Senegal, Canada, France, New Zealand, and Philippines. So Canada, if they could beat France now, who will be a little bit weakened, they are still going to have Tony Parker, Boris Diaw, and a lot of their European guys. It's looking a lot better for Canada because I don't think that if the French were at full strength, especially with Gobert and Batum, that Canada would have been the favorite there at all. But now I think it's probably about 50-50.
It is, except for how badly I think it was against Mexico that they lost, but I'm not completely sure, but just how dispiriting that was when a win would have put them in the Olympics.
All right, we're going to move on to the big men free agent rankings. But first, our friends at Vistaprint. They are offering 500 business cards for just $9.99 when you enter my promo code CAPSPACE at checkout. I am a small business owner, and they have been great for me, helping me create promotional materials, business cards as well with my logo on it. And they have plenty of custom products, whether it's home or office needs, even if you want to do t-shirts for a family party or something like that, postcards, flyers, banners, invitations, coffee mugs, whatever you want to put a logo on, whatever you want to put a phrase on, Vistaprint can do that for you. And their user interface is extremely friendly. Took me maybe 15 minutes or so to upload my business cards, select all the options that I wanted, and then they arrived, within a week or so. And if you want to customize it, you can do that. You can upgrade to a thicker stock, a brilliant finish. They also have templates for specific industries. Really, the world is at your fingertips when it comes to printing with Vistaprint. And the way to get started is with those 500 business cards starting at just $9.99. Use our code CAPSPACE at checkout. That's essential so that they know that you came from us and will continue advertising on the program. It's up to 50% savings over the regular site pricing using that code CAPSPACE. 500 business cards for just $9.99 at Vistaprint.com. All right, we have a lot of interesting bigs. For if you didn't listen to the point guards yesterday, the way I do this is I classify by star or by superstar, star, starter. And when I think of starter, it's not like, oh, this guy can be a starter. Maybe I'm talking about you sign this guy and you feel like, all right, for at least the next 2 or 3 years, we've got this position locked down. We can count on this guy. Then rotation, it's pretty obvious. And then fringe guys who just are not really established. Now, obviously, those are fluid. Some guys in some categories have more potential to move into one category or another, but this is the best that I could do, and we will go through the rankings here. Let's start with the unrestricted free agent stars. I said that they were Hassan Whiteside, age 27, Al Horford, age 30, and Dirk Nowitzki, age 38, who almost certainly will be going back to the Mavericks, and we don't really need to talk about him much more.
I have no arguments with the inclusion or exclusion of anybody from that list.
Well, the most controversial exclusion, perhaps, would be Dwight Howard as a starter rather than a star, but I take it you're in agreement with that.
I am in agreement with it. Part of it was seeing him up close in person with that Warriors series. When he's at his best, he is still a really impactful player. But that's just not consistent enough for me to put him in the star category, and it wasn't even consistent enough within the short playoff run they had to justify that.
If Houston's defense had been better this year, I would consider still putting him in the star category. But they were so bad defensively, and he was a big part of that. There's really at pretty much every time in his career up until this year, if he was on a defense, it was pretty good. It was top 10, even in his prime in Orlando, it was a top 3 defense every year, basically with him as the only guy on that defense who was any good. He had playing with like Hedo Turkoglu and Ryan Anderson and Rashard Lewis as the big man next to him, and still had, a top 3 defense every single year. And obviously the coaching of Van Gundy helped with that also. But yeah, I think that's the case. His offense also, he's not really a threat in the post anymore. And, he had a very revealing interview, which I recommend you read with Jackie McMullen today, talking about how he did kind of lose interest over the course of the year because he was not as big a part of the offense. But he's just not good enough to be that anymore, frankly. And that's fine. He could just be a pick-and-roll threat and get alley-oops and offensive rebounds on offense, and then just be a great defensive player, but we don't see that he is a great defensive player anymore, and that's why I feel like he does have a player option for this year. So he's claiming that he might not opt into it, which is obviously or that he might opt into it, which is obviously BS. He should absolutely still become a free agent. But yeah, I think he's just a little bit below the level of Whiteside and Horford, especially because Whiteside has a little bit more upside to explore.
And the only other guy, the only restricted free agent that you had in this tier is Andre Drummond, which I also agree with. There is serious potential that at just 22 that he could become a superstar, but to me, you cannot be put into that group prospectively. You have to earn your way in.
Yeah, he has the defensive potential. I think that Stan can continue to work with him, but he is a little bit spacey. There's also the free throw issue, which, while even if they take away Haka, it still can be an issue where if he's part of the play, you can follow him. He's going to set a screen or whatever. And also just his lack of moves. I think, I don't know that he's going to really be a post-up guy either, per se. But yeah, I think he still is more of a star. Now, he's going to get maxed out, and he's going to stay with the Pistons almost certainly. The owner has already said he's a max player. I think they just asked him to wait now because they can use his small cap hold to have some more flexibility this offseason and hopefully maybe get a decent backup point guard on the team. Although, as we talked about yesterday, there aren't that many of those. So I think we can kind of leave out the idea of him changing teams, and he's going to get maxed out. It's actually, kind of not that interesting for him. I don't think the odds of him even ever getting to a restricted free agent contract, because the Pistons can offer him that fifth year and the higher raises, seems unlikely.
Yeah, and I'm sure if he demands it, they'll give him a 4+1, which is what I assume he will agree to.
So I did not see any restricted free agents who are starters, although there are some very intriguing restricted free agents in that I categorize as rotation that might be a decent bet to mature into starters. Maybe we can talk about them first. Heading that group to me, and I'll go through the whole list and you can say where you feel differently perhaps, and we'll say these guys' ages too. I think that Festus Ezeli is about to turn 27. He's at the head of that for me. He would be in the starter category if he had not spent a lot of this year injured. It's more of a health risk to me than, I don't think he's ever going to be a top 15 center in the league, but I think he can be, especially with his offensive rebounding, his intensity, his ability to run the floor, that he could be a nice starter for someone as long as he could stay healthy. You don't want to give him too long of a contract because he's very reliant on athleticism and he's already going to be 27. But so he heads that list to me. And then Myers Leonard, age 24, another big who I think could become at some point, a Channing Frye type of threat with his three-pointer, but he has to be played at center. He's really been playing out of position at power forward all year and didn't look as good, and now he has this shoulder injury. Those are really the two that I look at as like guys who I feel like have a decent chance of becoming starters, but because they're not yet established, I wouldn't put them quite in that category.
I'm a lot closer on Ezeli than I am with Leonard, just because the defensive value is already there. Like, it's easier to see with Ezeli, and you're right, the health issue, I wouldn't have him as a starter, but it's close. Like, when I was drawing those lines, he was one that I agonized over. Actually, one of the only guys that I really agonized over in the big man group, and some of the other ones, that was a harder call. Like, we talked about Jeremy Lin yesterday. But I agree with where that turned out. With Myers Leonard, part of it is also that he's a wonderful change of pace guy, so I actually think he should play with starters with some frequency, but I don't think he should be getting 28 to 35 minutes a game. So maybe you play him a little bit differently, but I don't think...
Yeah, he hasn't shown that he can stop anybody at either big...
Exactly, so you can't treat him that way, but I also think that both of those guys have a serious possibility of getting starter money or close to it, because you are paying for what they'll be 2 years from now more than what you're paying for right now, and because this market is just insane.
So below that, among the restricted free agents, are some guys who, have started at times in their career, have looked pretty good. Donatas Mataiunas, 25, biggest issue for him. Number one, can he defend the center position? Number two, his health with that back injury that kept him out most of the year and by some accounts caused him to flunk that physical after being traded to the Pistons. Boban Marjanovic, who is, because it's his first year, teams are limited in what they can offer him. They can only offer him the mid-level exception of $5.6 million, basically over the first 2 years. We explained more about how the arenas provision works yesterday with Jordan Clarkson, so if you want to hear that, go back and listen to it. But same thing basically applies to Boban. And then Miles Plumlee, age 27. Jared Sollinger, 24. I think he's probably the most controversial and a guy who might be valued higher by a lot of people than by me. Tyler Zeller, age 26. And then Terrence Jones, who had a completely lost season this year at 24, but has been a rotation player in the past.
When we did our mock rookie extension thing, as the Rockets GM, I was willing to pay both Demo and Terrence Jones starter money. And boy, are the Rockets lucky that, well, we don't know what offers were on the table, but I assume both those guys have evaporated in terms of their value.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting. The Rockets have big plans right now. Both those guys have cap holds that are relatively smaller. I think they're both under $6 million. And maybe the Rockets will even say, hey, we're going to just get rid of these guys' cap holds, pull their qualifying offer, and see what we can get on the free agent market instead. Jones, I mean, the same problem as Demo, haven't really proven that they can be great defensive players at the four or the five. Jones really struggles with his intensity. You know, I don't know what his health situation is. I mean, to be completely out of the rotation on this Rockets team that was not incredibly deep, it does not look good. I think actually someone, Boban, what do you think of Boban? I mean, would you, if you were a team, would you be trying to get him as like, you know, and count on him as like a major rotation piece?
I think he actually is helped by the Arenas provision in the sense of you are taking a risk on him, but it just curtails that a little bit. I wouldn't want to give him $10 million a year, but he's probably not going to get that anyway. But as somebody who you're giving him, let's say, 15 to 18 minutes a game, I'd be okay with that.
Yeah, and also note that if you're giving a restricted free agent an offer, it has to be at least two
right.
years, and there are a bunch of other restrictions on it as well. But so it's not like you could say, oh yeah, we'll just give him a 1 year, you know, $10 million deal. Like that's, you're not allowed to do that. You have to have at least two guaranteed years on an offer sheet. And I mean, for Boban, I think that he could be effective in the right matchup. He almost, in some respects, is better as a starter because you know he'll have a center to go up against. But he really breaks down when he has to get in pick and roll defense with any player who can shoot the ball off the dribble or any kind of shooting big man. He's just not going to be able to close out on, you know, the Warriors, for example, whenever he came in, put in Spates and Spates killed him, you know, and Spates isn't some like unstoppable force. But he means, I think that Miles Plumlee is someone that I would look at. I don't think that the Bucks particularly value him that highly as a restricted free agent. He is already 27 because he was 24 when he was drafted by the Pacers, but he's athletic. He can protect the rim reasonably well. And if you're one of these teams that kind of likes to play small, I mean, he had some nice years in Phoenix. If you need someone who can get up for alley-oops on pick and rolls and get some defensive rebounds, you know, maybe he could be a guy that you could start, but, you know, you only played him 20 minutes a game or something like that, and then you finish games small. You know, he's not, I don't think that your center position is solved when you have Miles Plumlee, but I think that he is someone who can definitely be a solid rotation big man. And he just kind of got buried in Milwaukee behind Greg Monroe and John Henson.
I would be so much more comfortable signing him for like a 2-year contract than the possibility of giving him 3 or more, just because we don't know. And if that is available, you know, if he can get a crazy number for 3 or 4 years, he should absolutely take it. But if I were a GM, that would just be terrifying.
All right, so Jared Sollinger, I have below a lot of these guys. He started most of the year on a good team, the Celtics. My thinking is that especially when you saw him in the playoffs against Atlanta, he's doesn't protect the rim, and he's also too slow to get out on shooters and not that great in the pick and roll either. And so just especially if you're in the playoffs, he can really be attacked defensively, and he doesn't quite give you enough on the offensive end. If he really were reliable from three-point range and on his long twos, or, you know, really was a guy that you could go to in the post for buckets, I might feel differently about him. But I felt like he was really, while he does have decent hands and he's kind of intelligent, I thought he was kind of riding the coattails of those great Boston guards defensively, and that especially if you put him in another system, he could really, really get exposed.
He's a man without a country for me because he doesn't have enough versatility to his game to really play the four offensively. And at the five, he's, you know, he can do some things there when you put him against centers, but he can't man...
Yeah. And he certainly can't guard them.
Exactly. So you have to think of him. You have to think of him more as a five, and he doesn't bring what you need at that position. So then you're starting to think of him as a change of pace guy. And when somebody is a change of pace player, you can't have them as a starter. At least you can't pay them that kind of money unless they have a ceiling that is a lot higher, like Myers Leonard. Like, Myers Leonard could eventually do some of the things that he needs to do, those gaps in his game, and they're about the same age. I just think Leonard, with his size and with his athleticism, is more likely to fill those, and he's just a bigger dude.
Yeah, Leonard is 7'1". Yeah. Like, that's, I mean, he is huge.
He's a big guy. Yeah, I actually spent some time talking to him before he got drafted, and just, he was a big guy. Still is.
Well, and the other thing about Solinger, too, is he had back surgery his first year in the league. He had that broken foot basically because he was enormous. He got into better shape this year, his free agent year. But in general, you know, especially, you know, you see kind of what his genetics are, if you see his dad, too, that it's, I think it's very unlikely that he is always going to be in optimum shape, especially if you're going to pay him. Let's talk about the rest of the guys that I had in the starter category among the unrestricted. And this is sort of an interesting line of demarcation. We may not agree on these. So other than Dwight Howard, Bismack Biyombo I had. I did these rankings in the middle of the Miami series when he looked awesome. He has not looked quite as good since then against the Cavs, but, you know, the Cavs will make a lot of centers look bad. Biyombo has a player option that he almost certainly will opt out of, and he is listed at age 23. There is certainly some skepticism about that age, though. So, but I think as long as you're giving him a contract that's 3 years, maybe even four, even if he's 25 instead of 23, you don't want to maybe project out that he's going to improve a ton. But I think he's been a starter-level player this year regardless.
When there are a lot of guys, and I feel this way, big men who are good for 15 to 18 minutes a game, you can look for a little bit smaller of a role for the center. Like, I don't necessarily love Biyombo playing 32 minutes a game, but if he can give you 26, 28 really intense minutes, I think he can do that.
Yeah, and also where he doesn't have to worry about foul trouble as well. I think that's also helpful. I had him ranked above Jan Mahimi. I think Mahimi is a better player in pretty much all facets right now, but Mahimi is 29. And so I think, you know, you don't really want to go big money for him, you know, starter money for him more than maybe 2 years out. That some team probably will. But, and I think he has really improved his offensive game. He was fantastic defending the basket this year. He's fantastic defending the basket in the Toronto series. And also, I think he's quite gettable because Nate McMillan and Larry Bird both view Miles Turner as the center of the future. Maybe he's not there quite yet, but do you want to, especially if it's a little bit longer term a contract, are they going to want to commit to Mahimi? He does have a smaller cap hold than he's likely to get paid, so that might be a reason they bring him back. But I think if Mahimi is offered a starting position, he would probably rather do that than come back to Indiana where he's not going to be the
quarterback. And it's his choice. That's something that is very important in this, is that he's not like a restricted free agent, so he can choose the role that is best for him, and he will have some good offers out there. I mean, we talked a little bit about some of the possibilities with the Spurs. Who knows what happens if Duncan comes back? Of course, that's something different. But I think Mahimi is going to get at least one, probably two, really strong combinations of playing time and money, and I expect him to leave.
So the other three that I had in the starter category, Joakim Noah, he's going to be 31. I thought that he looked really good defensively until he got hurt. He obviously has had health problems. He's had big-time problems finishing around the rim the last couple of years. He was starting, actually, to find his confidence. I still think he's, and his passing is nice. His ability to switch, I think he'll still be able to do that. Pretty good on the defensive glass, moves his feet. His shot blocking is going to wane at his age for sure, and he's also kind of injury prone. But I still think that for a couple of years, he could be a starting center for you, especially for a team that really likes to move the ball, that has shooting around him. You know, he could be great in like the DHO game, hitting guys backdoor. And then if you have enough shooting around him, when he rolls to the basket and it's not totally clogged up in there, he might still be able to actually be somewhat effective finishing. And he's good on the offensive board. So I would still give him starter money for a year or two. And then not a guy who really compares to him that well, but Ryan Anderson, who is going to be 28, stretch four. And then Tim Duncan as a player option. He's not going anywhere. Obviously, he'll be back in San Antonio at age 40 if he doesn't retire, so we can stop talking about him. But I mean, do you think I have that order pretty well among those starters? Is there anyone else you'd put in the starter category or anyone you would have higher?
There isn't anybody that I would add in, though. We'll talk about there's somebody who I think is on the margin, but I don't love Noah in this group. He certainly has the potential, but how I would phrase it to you is, if you were to give them, let's say, a two-year contract, let's not care about the money because that doesn't matter, but let's say for the next 2 years, you could have Festus Ezeli or Joakim Noah playing 28 minutes a game. You'd rather have Noah?
Well, the biggest issue is just, I think, the health thing for Azealia, which is even more worrisome to me than Noah's is. I mean, Noah had a shoulder injury. He actually looked very spry. He was at P3 before this. He's made it through every year until, except for this year, and the shoulder injury is not something that should be something that really affects his mobility or his game going forward. I think that Festus will be a better player, but I just don't trust. I mean, he's had so many knee issues now, that, and I think you're going to have to give Festus a longer contract as well, is the other reason why I think, you know, I think I would like Noah just because of the risk. And you also know that Noah, even if his athleticism declines, like, he's still going to be able to do some things. So yeah, I mean, I see where you're at on that, but I think just the risk with Azealia, you know, I mean, has he ever played even 15 minutes a game in a season? That's why I would have him a little bit below Noah. And also, you know, when a guy is restricted, that means he is probably going to have to, if he's going to change teams, he's going to have to get paid more than someone who's unrestricted to prevent.
Right. I focused more on the playing part because I agree with you on all of that.
Yeah.
But I would have Noah, if he's in this tier, which I would be a little bit dubious, but it's close. He would be the last guy in that group. Anderson scares me because, you know, he has these back injuries and he's somebody who might not age well, and he's already having trouble defensively. Granted, having trouble defensively at power forward is a very different thing than at a center spot. So, you know, I could give him that. Another guy, though, who there are a lot of these in the center group who might be starter quality, but if you gave them a 3-year deal at starter money, you're feeling queasy because you're not getting surplus value from Ryan Anderson to the point where it's like, oh yeah, we can justify that. It's different than Mike Conley, let's say, or Al Horford, where you have that kind of an issue. So I would do it if I had to and I were the right team and he was the perfect guy, you know, maybe the only person available, do that. And Duncan, you know, as long as he wants to play, you can pencil him in another low minute starter, but still a starter.
Yeah, Anderson, we talked about with the point guards, and I think this is one of the real interesting questions is, who is the league going to value more than maybe you and I are valuing someone? I think Anderson, the $20 million a year figure has been bandied about for him. I think that would be complete insanity, especially because there's no reason that you can't just go small against him, right? Like, he's not a devastating enough post-up player that most wing, I mean, he's going to give back more on defense against a wing than he's going to take back trying to post that guy up. He can't get on the offensive glass a little bit, but at age 28 with his injury history, that skill is really going to be something that wanes. And so I think he's just going to be kind of hanging out at the three-point line, where he's an excellent shooter and he's a threat to be sure. But I don't think that he is going to be the kind of guy who breaks defenses, because you can just go small against him pretty easily.
Agreed.
So rotation, Pau Gasol heads this for me. I'm certain he made the All-Star team, although due to injury replacement the last 2 years. He has a player option for $7 million that he will almost certainly opt out of, which would be a solid financial decision. And he is age 35. The reason I would not want him as a starter at starter money is because he just is not good enough defensively, and his post-up ability, he just doesn't really have that anymore unless it's against some of the worst defenders, which is would actually be solid on the second unit. If you're going up against backup centers, yeah, then I think he can score more, but he's really been reduced to a pick-and-pop guy, no good passer certainly, on offense, and then defensively he just can't move his feet at all. One of the worst defensive rebounding centers in the league. The Bulls, although he would get a lot of raw defensive rebounds, Bulls always were horrible defensive rebounding with him on the court. He just can't get a clean defensive rebound. Even when he does, it sort of like bounces around in his hands and he has to like tip it or grab it. Like, it's really, you are killing your defensive rebounding by having him out there. And that's, and again, playing him in shorter minutes, maybe he can play with more effort as well. But if you play him at center, you would be very, very hard pressed to have a good defense. And that's why I think of him as someone that I would not want necessarily as a starter, paying starter money to in the longer term.
There is an insane,
or even 2 years.
There is an insanely good chance that I'm going to hate his contract. And that is not because I dislike Pau Gasol. I like him immensely, but he will likely have the choice between being a smaller part of a much bigger team or being a bigger part of a slightly smaller team. And considering that will likely have a financial difference, considering the flexibility of how those teams generally separate, I feel like he's going to choose the bigger role on maybe a little bit lesser of a team. And it's just going to be, it's going to be sad because he can't handle that right
yeah.
now.
No, not if you want your team to be good. I mean, you can totally put up 17 and 11 on some team that's going to have a bad defense. You know, go ahead and be the starter and play 35 minutes a game like he has the last 2 years in Chicago. But it's going to be really difficult for a good team. And I mean, part of the reason that I'm scared off by him is just, it's never been publicly stated, but I think an implicit promise that was made to him that he was always going to start when he was in Chicago. And with him at his age, with his limitations, if he's going to get prickly about not starting, about not closing games, you know, I mean, the Bulls even went to Cristiano Felicio down the stretch, finally, you know, five games too late as they desperately tried to make the playoffs this year. And it was the right move to close games because he just does not play with any kind of force anymore. You know, he's 35 years old. It's not a surprise.
It isn't. So the next guy you have, who I would actually have a little bit lower despite liking him a lot, is Nene. Nene is 33. I love him as a rotation guy. You know, if you can give him, again, 20 minutes or less a game, he has good post defense. He tries offensively, but there are a couple guys that I just like a little bit more than him.
I think everyone tries offensively. I think there are very few guys in the league that I would say they don't try offensively. Maybe DeMar DeRozan.
Oh, he tries.
Well, no, but like he doesn't try and he doesn't try to like actually like get open off the ball or anything. I don't know. That's too in the weeds. But yeah, that would be a funny question though. Like, who doesn't try offensively?
We will take reader submissions.
Well, so let's give a little more context here with some of these guys, and you can explain why you think you would have him lower. Cole Aldrich has a player option for the minimum at age 27. He will opt out. He actually had over a 20 PER this year, and I thought was really helpful for the Clippers in stabilizing that bench. I think he's someone who it wouldn't absolutely shock me if he ascended to starter level. Again, more of sort of these traditional center 20, 25 minute a game starter types, but you know, pretty solid rim protector, can roll to the basket. Okay, hook shot on occasion if he catches the ball on a roll or gets a mismatch. I mean, I was impressed with what he was able to do this year. Zaza Pachulia, who started much of the year, he is 32 with a question mark because he was supposedly 19 when he came into the league, and that was highly questionable. I also had Al Jefferson, who is 31, Jarrell Arthur at 28, and Timofey Mozgov at 29 would sort of be a tier within there. I don't want to list out all the guys, but how do you feel about those guys shaking out? Why would you have Nene lower among those guys?
I really like Cole Aldrich. I think that he protects the rim well. He has been underutilized. I thought him signing that contract with the Clippers was a coup for them. It is unfortunate that they won't be able to really bring him back because all they have is non-bird rights, and he's going to command a whole lot more money than that. I think he'll be a contract that will shock people, but I'll like it. And I think, you know, another guy who is really nice in this role, and, you know, maybe if he can ratchet it up from 20 to 28, I think it's possible. There are teams that are going to be desperate enough, and you can do it in spot minutes, too. Like, maybe he's not a starter long-term, but your guy goes down for 8 games with an ankle injury or something like that, you can do it. Zaza Pachulia, to me, delivered more the last couple of years than Nene has. I think he can do that, and they're about the same age, so it's not the issue where, oh, he's going to fall off a cliff faster. You know, it's possible. And I think Mozgov, while he had an immensely disappointing season, he has...
Yeah, due to that knee injury, I think. But then he just never got in rhythm after that. And I don't know. He's 29, so I don't know whether it's an issue of him just, you know, not ever being the same again. You know, he played on it all last playoffs. Or whether it's the type of thing where he can be better
next year. His 2014-15 was the best year, in my opinion, that any of the guys in this tier have had recently. And that includes Pau Gasol making the All-Star team this year. I thought Mozgov was great last year for a vast majority of the time. And if you're not going to be getting him at a starter price, then that's fantastic. You know, I think that he might end up being the best value of this group on top of being the best player.
Yeah, we just don't know that he's going to be healthy. And I feel badly for him because he busted his ass to play on a sore knee in the playoffs and get them to the finals. He was so important in their finals run. And now he's out of the rotation this year. I mean, it's probably cost him at least $30 million, if not more.
Yeah, he's lost himself more money than Ty Lawson did, which is pretty amazing.
What do you think of Jarrell Arthur?
You like him more than I do, but he definitely deserves a spot in an NBA rotation.
He has a player option, by the way.
I think it's 3.2 or something like that. I like him, but I don't think he's really a high upside guy anymore. He's somebody who can...
No, he's 28.
He can scale up his minutes a little bit. You know, at certain moments, I felt that he was a little bit underutilized, but I broadly feel that power forward only guys just aren't that valuable unless you bring something special to the table, which I don't believe he does.
Well, here's why. I mean, he shot the ball better. You know, that could be a mirage. It's not enough attempts to know whether his better shooting on long two and stretching out finally to the 3-point line is meaningful, but he's a guy who can switch really well. And I think, you know, can guard most backup centers okay and can shoot the ball well enough that he's not going to be a total liability on offense. They always seem to play better with him on the floor. He's just a very, very good defensive player. You know, I think he and Anthony Tolliver, but, you know, are very similar mold. Tolliver is a better shooter, but he's also 31. And Tolliver has been a valuable player for the last 2, 3, 4 years now. If Arthur can continue to refine that three-point shot for the next 2 years, I think he could be a very solid guy off the bench of like a good defensive second unit. And that's why I kind of like him. Mozgov, the only reason I have him so low is just the health questions. Al Jefferson, do you think he should be higher or lower, or is he kind of properly talked about? I mean, he's started for most of his career. I think he is very clearly at age 31 now a bench guy.
If you made relative to every guy but Mozgov, who I've already said should be higher, it's fine. We've talked about Jefferson before. I think he's a great flashpoint for how I see the league, that he could be very well used as a second unit center and just brutalize those players, whether they are centers like him, you know, because I think we'll see more of those kind of players, the Enes Kanters of the world, move to that lineup, or, you know, the teams that go in other directions with their second unit center. Like, it would be fun to see him and Myers Leonard go at it for like a game and just see how that works, because they have such different strengths. But if you start him, your defense is probably not going to be good. Charlotte did it, but that's because Steve Clifford is a goddamn wizard, and I don't understand how that happened.
And he still got attacked really badly in the playoffs as well. You know, again, and I probably am guilty in all of this of focusing a little bit too much on kind of a playoffs perspective, a little bit too much on like what would be ideal. You know, I mean, they're a lot of these guys are going to end up starting, even though I have them in the rotation category. But I'm thinking just in terms of like when I want to pay starter money, you know, over $15 million a year on a long-term contract, I want to feel like, all right, this position is locked down, that, you know, this is a playoff quality starter. And so maybe I'm a little bit too stingy with who I'm considering starter.
I think that's fair. Like, you don't want to draw a starter. Like, it's not the equivalent of the Hall of Fame of, are you better than the worst guy? You know, it's you think of it on a more objective standard, because the starting point guard for the Nets this year, and probably, and depending on who they get next year, will be substantially worse. They won't be one of the 30 best point guards in the league, but you have to hold it to that standard, not only because that's how you're paying them, but because that's how you have to see the league.
So the rest of the guys that I thought of as rotation players, Roy Hibbert is 29. David West has a player option for the minimum at 35. Mirza Teletovic is 30. Maurice Spates, 28, but has the body of a 33-year-old. Anthony Tolliver, 31, and David Lee sometimes has the body of a 31-year-old and sometimes has the body of a 38-year-old, depending on whether he decides to be in shape. He is 33, however.
The last three guys I've covered as members of the Golden State Warriors, which is fun. Not all at different times, but at different times. And I would lean of that group towards Spates, even though his flaws will be magnified anywhere else, but just because I like him more as a fifth big man than a third or a fourth big man, but he has talent. He has, you know, he can be a good teammate in terms of spirit and all that.
Yeah, I mean, he's another guy that, especially with his ability to shoot the three, he can hold up okay enough as a center against most bench units, unless they just have some awesome pick and roll guy who's in at the time. And he shoots threes as a center, he's the only one of those groups where if you can shoot threes as a center, that is a real matchup problem for the other team. I think of the rest of these guys, you know, Hibbert, maybe once he gets out of L.A., he did seem to be in a little better shape last year. He's just a complete offensive liability. We've talked about that many times, how he can't run pick and roll. He's not explosive enough to finish from the dunker position, and he can't move to a spot and get open, and his jumper isn't really good enough either, and he's not even that much of a post-up guy. But, you know, I think he could still be effective defensively. Again, a guy who I might want to take a flyer on, especially if I'm a team that doesn't really have any rim protection, and maybe he could end up starting for you in certain matchups, or at least giving you like some good defense on the second unit. Teletovic, I like okay. I just wish, you know, he's older than you think he is, because he came over from Europe pretty recently. I think he can be, is a little underrated defensively, but, you know, kind of a stretch for it. I certainly would rather pay him than Ryan Anderson, you know, who I think they're actually like relatively similar players. Anderson's a little bit higher volume shooter, but Teletovic is probably actually better defensively.
And Teletovic was actually, because I was tracking this stuff for Warriors World, because I was one of my favorite random things, he was one of the few guys that shot at any volume that for moments of the year had a better shooting percentage on above the break threes than Stephen Curry. Him and JJ Redick were really the only two guys. Oh, and Chris Middleton.
Lee, I would have pretty close to the fringe. I think that the only way he can be effective is playing center on a very small second unit that runs pick and roll a lot. You know, his jumper has completely abandoned him. He can't protect the rim anymore. He's not any good on the glass anymore. You know, if he's in shape, he can get out in transition a little bit still, but, you know, he's just not really a player that you feel even great about in your rotation because of the fit issues. Dallas was a great place for him. Hopefully he will return there for not too much money. I think that would be good for him, and maybe, you know, Dallas can get something out of him. I think anybody who signs him to play power forward is going to get the same problems that they got from him in Boston.
We actually could benefit from this move that we've advocated for going more back to the basket Burley centers, because Lee is bad defensively, but he can actually do a decent job against those guys, and offensively he can exploit their lack of mobility. So if the league actually follows our lead and goes to more of the Al Jefferson at center, backup center types, I think Lee could actually do reasonably well against them for another year or two.
So of these guys, who do you think the league would value higher than we do, or lower than we do?
I think David Lee's going to get some money because he still has that championship aura. Spates might, because he's still a member of the Warriors. Teletovic, I think people are lower on than us. As you said, you made the comparison to Ryan Anderson. I would have their numbers, like, in my eyes, they'd be pretty similar, especially because Teletovic doesn't appear to have the injury concerns, but their compensation is probably going to be dramatically different.
Yeah, well, he did have the clotting issue a couple of years ago, but he seems to have beaten that. We cross our fingers to say that.
That's different than, like, the back stuff that Anderson would be dealing with for the rest of his life, regrettably. And the two most interesting contracts of this entire big man group for me, maybe other than Cole Aldrich, are the two former Pacers, Hibbert and West. West willingly took a gigantic pay cut. We have no idea if he's going to do that again or if he wants to do something totally different. So he has self-imposed variability. Hibbert has variability because I don't know if anybody's comfortable with how good they think he is right now.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that Mozgov might be another guy. I don't know whether he is going to be, whether we are overvaluing him or undervaluing him. I mean, if I had to guess, you know, I think he might get, you know, a 2-year, $12 million deal, which is pretty much just like straight up backup money with the hope that he has some upside. I mean, I think that he and Aldridge are the two guys in this group who are most likely to actually to ascend to the starter level if given some opportunity. You know, I think the rest of these guys are pretty limited. I really just like Nene for a playoff team. You know, all right, so he plays 55 games during the season, but if he's actually ready and he can give you 20 minutes off the bench, still an excellent defensive player, and, you know, can play pick and roll a little bit, a solid passer. I think that he is just someone who can give you 20 very, very good minutes in the playoffs at a high level. So even though his availability isn't as high as some of these other guys, I think that he can reach a better level still in a way that's not going to be exploited as easily when you really get into playing some of the higher level teams in playoff action.
And there is a duality with the big men in this, which is that there are a lot of guys on this group, and there are some that duplicate one another, but there is so much demand for these spots that I think we're just going to see a lot of money get out there. I mean, I don't think either of us loves Tyler Zeller or Hibbert, but I feel like eventually when you know, 95% of the guys above them get knocked out, somebody's going to freak out and look and see X as their starting center and just freak out and give those guys money.
Well, let's take a look at this of who really is going to need a starting center, though. You know, Atlanta, if they re-sign Al Horford, they're not going to. Brooklyn, Brook Lopez. The Celtics, you know, they've got some guys on there. I don't think they would really be in sort of this rotation level of guys we're talking about. Charlotte, I think they got Cody Zeller. I think they feel okay. Chicago definitely needs someone. Cleveland doesn't. The Mavs definitely need someone. Denver does not. Detroit does not. They'll bring back Drummond. The Warriors don't. Houston, I guess, probably does, unless they want to roll with Capella. The Pacers may or may not. Yeah, I guess there's, you know, I don't want to go through the entire league, but yeah, I guess there is really about half the league that could probably use either a starting center or someone pretty close to that. And definitely plenty of teams that just, you know, don't have enough rim protection and could use someone of that ilk, especially more than maybe some of these offensive
players. Yeah, I think that's definitely fair.
So we'll run a little long here. So we'll just talk about some of the fringe guys. Kevin Serafin, 26. This is for the unrestricteds. Trevor Booker, 28. Jason Smith actually had a very nice year with the Magic, mostly built on unsustainable shooting on long twos. Jordan Hill, 28. Thomas Robinson is a player option at 25. He'll probably opt out. Brandon Bass is reported to do so already at 31. Quincy Acey at 25. Then the rest of the guys are really just not that exciting. Those are in order of how I wanted to go.
I like John Lure. I'll mention I like John Lure.
Oh, yeah? Okay, yeah. Is there anyone below there that you're
just John
excited
Lure.
About?
That's it.
Yeah, at age 27, a guy you can shoot a little bit. I mean, he doesn't really bring anything on the boards or blocking shots.
He should just be on a roster. Like, I don't think he should be in a reliable rotation spot, but him, Jason Smith, and Booker, to me, are the guys who, like, I would be shocked. Like, they definitely deserve a place. There are a lot of the other ones that I'd be comfortable, you know, if you have that, if depending on how your roster turns out, if that's, like, your last spot, sure, totally fine. And there are two guys on the restricted side that I would definitely want to make sure were on a roster.
Yeah, well, let's get to them in a second. I think that Robinson actually made some strides defending the rim this year. Still pretty bad at scoring, but he has enough physical tools that I think that, especially if you wanted to just play him at center on the second unit, he's always been a great rebounder. He can get out and run in transition. If he had, like, the right coach defensively, I feel like maybe something could still be made of him. He has, with the athleticism he has, he obviously doesn't have much in the way of feel, to be sure, but I think he is, as one of the younger ones of these guys, has some tools. Quincy Acey is only 25, too. I think he's one that I looked at. I think that Bass could still be a fourth big man on a decent team, you know, as a guy who can switch a little bit, not the most intelligent defender, but at least, you know, won't kill you defensively. And then Serafin, you know, was kind of off the radar this year. He's a pretty big body, someone who can protect the rim a little bit, get some boards. You know, I wouldn't mind him on a team where he was the backup center, but also the fourth big man. So where you're really going with, you know, and he's only playing maybe like 12 minutes a game, and you've got a kind of more power forward type who's your third big man who plays more. I think he could be okay in that role. So what do you think about the restricted guys?
I still like Andrew Nicholson. I think he can figure it out. Not saying I would give him a ton of money, but I think as a power forward type guy, you can sort of...
So does Scott Skiles on every odd Tuesday.
Yeah, every once in a while. And then the other guy is Willie Reed. I think Willie Reed has a lot of physical potential. Again, wouldn't give him a ton of money, but think if he's... Like, let's say you had two guys that were competing to be your fourth big man, I would be very happy to have Willie Reed in that competition.
Yeah, Nicholson is 26, but he is a stretch big. He's got some post-up ability, not totally unathletic. He's someone I might give a shot to. I think he just kind of got buried in Orlando behind all their 8 million power forwards that they had there. Dwight Powell at age 24, I think, can shoot the three a little bit. He's got some bounce to him, some athleticism, a little bit light, you know, where he's not going to do too well on post-ups. But if he can continue to refine that shot and could be a guy maybe who could switch defensively and I don't know about protecting the rim so much maybe, but you know, just a guy who can be an athlete. He's restricted with the Mavericks. Willie Reed, I think, is fine too. What about James McAdoo with the Warriors? I mean, he's got to get, you'd think he would get some sort of an offer just because he was on the Warriors, right? He's 23 and pretty athletic, but really more of as a center in a power forward's body.
Yeah, he was a guy that I really liked as a young prospect because I thought, you know, if he could put the pieces together, the problem is that he stayed in college long enough to make it seem like he wasn't going to. Yeah, he definitely will. I think he'll have a spot in professional basketball, in high-end professional basketball, and that very well could be the NBA. But having seen enough of him, it's really hard for me to imagine him in the next year or two being like, even if it was in a spot thing, saying, okay, these are 10 minutes that are kind of important. Let's say our backup center got hurt. Go do that and not be biting your nails all the way down to their nubs. Like, that's just, he's a good guy and he can get to that place. He's only 23, but he's not there yet.
He's got some bounce. He could maybe be someday like a poor man's Brandon, right? You know, as your backup center when you're playing with a traditional three as your four man, you know, again, the way the Mavericks like to play on their second unit with Parsons at the four, get him rolling to the rim, get up for some alley-oops. He's working on his mid-ranger. I think he can hit like a standstill 15-footer. I don't think he's going to stretch it out to the three-point line anytime soon. And then, of course, your boy Christian Wood, who kind of bounced around with the Sixers a little bit. He's restricted, age 20, a lot of physical talent, but, you know, I think he's kind of so far out of it now that I wouldn't. I mean, as you could do worse as you're the last guy on the bench, but I don't see him getting an offer in restricted free agency that's going to be more than the minimum. So unless the Sixers just completely let him go, I would imagine he'll be still there or just out of the league completely.
Derek Bodner and I talked about him a little bit when I had him on because Derek knows the Sixers so well. And what we agreed on is that there's this weird parallel between him and Hassan Whiteside, not necessarily in terms of like, oh, he's going to be the next Hassan Whiteside, but that some time in the wilderness might do him some good because he has the physical tools to not only be an NBA player, but in my opinion, to be an NBA starter. But with where he is mentally and where he is in terms of his dedication, he is so far from that that you have to really kind of put him through the ringer to see if this is where he wants to go. And if he does that for 2 years in China or in Spain or something, he might come back and do a really nice job. But I'm not sure that the NBA is the right place for him right now.
Who's going to get the worst contract of everyone that we discussed?
Meaning just the fringe guys or overall?
No, this entire list of people.
Dwight, somebody's going to...
I'm going Ryan Anderson.
Oh, yeah, that's good. Yeah, like if Sacramento gives him, like, if Sacramento gives him 18 to 20,
just like...
If Sacramento gives him 18 to 20 million, like...
You're like, the visceral reaction you had at just, like, the pure comedy of, like, how bad that contract could be, I really enjoyed that.
There are some players in this year's class that are just going to... They're, like, we've talked about before that the moment from when you hear that a guy agreed to terms to when they are announced, Dwight and Ryan Anderson, I think, are going to be those two of, like, oh, God, where is this going to go? And, you know, both former teammates, actually. And I just think Dwight's going to get maxed by somebody, and the fourth year of that is going to be the mistake. Because he's just, I think that Dwight has still...
You think Dwight Howard is going to get a four-year max?
I think he is, and I think it's going to be a giant mistake.
Well, maybe. It all depends, too, if you're overpaying in the first couple of years, if that overpay is getting you something, number one, because you couldn't have spent that money on anything else that was any better in those years, and number two, because you're actually getting to another level with someone like him. I mean, and he, maybe if he's more engaged, he can get back to being a really good defensive player. He's had flashes of the ability still to move his feet out in the perimeter in that Warriors series at times, but, you know, he definitely does not have the same level of presence at the rim that he used to, and maybe he can get back to that if he's more engaged in a better defensive culture, but, you know, he's not the same intimidator back there the way, you know, someone like Steven Adams has been. You know, if you compare, like, how scared the Warriors were of Dwight versus Steven Adams, like, there's no comparison.
I agree with you, and what's also unfortunate with that is I would love to see Dwight take a little bit less money to be on a competitive team, because I think that he still has a lot to give there, but somebody, I think...
Yeah. Maybe he will. Like, if he went to Portland, maybe, like, I mean, he would be a great fit there. There are definitely places that he could be a great fit if he can get back to that prior defensive level, but I just really worry that, you know, this could be about it for him as a big defensive force.
And I don't think I think he's at the moment where he knows that it's a good time to cash out for him. So, like, yeah, I would rather pay him a lot more money for fewer years, but I don't think anybody is going to really get that opportunity to make that kind of an offer, because a couple of years from now, you know, he would be leaving a lot on the table to make that kind of...
Yeah, he actually said in that interview with Jackie McMullen that he anticipates this is going to be his last chance at a big contract.
Yeah, so he's not going to, like, take a two-year contract with the Heat if Hassan Whiteside goes somewhere else. Like, you know, that would be fun.
Well, two years, $30 million would be pretty good. Or $30 million a year, I mean, it would be pretty good. All right, well, do you want to make a friendly wager on whether Dwight gets four-year max or not? I say he will not.
It's hard because I'm not necessarily sure he'll take... how about if we made it $25 million annual value?
Oh, that it'll be... But it's got to be at least 4 years. So we'll do this. We'll say that his next contract will be less than $100 million.
Sure.
Is that
Let's
a good bet?
Let's do it. Option years count.
Yeah. Unless it's a team option. If it's a player option.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah, guaranteed money for him will be less than $100 million is what I'm saying. What are the stakes? The loser has to watch, like, 25 consecutive games of whatever team DeMar DeRozan is on next year?
No, the winner gets to pick three games that the loser has to watch all of DeMar DeRozan's shots twice. And it could be any game during the
regular. All right, let's work on this over GChat over the weekend. We're gonna be in Oklahoma City together. We can solicit some of those opinions, too, on what the stakes of this bet should be. We can report back on the next show. That's a good start, though. I'm liking the way you're thinking. All right, you got anything to plug before we go?
So I wrote two Game 2 analysis pieces for The Athletic, and my I'm going to keep doing off-season previews. I'm actually not sure if one is going up tomorrow. I think one should be going up. And I recorded Real Jam Radio, my podcast, with Jared Weiss, talking about the Boston Celtics, who I think have one of the most exciting off-seasons of anybody in the league.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to listening to that, probably as I'm sitting right next to you on the plane to Oklahoma City. If you fall asleep and you won't talk to me anymore, then I can just listen to your podcast. It's really, I need more Danny in my life,
that is
apparently.
A giant mistake.
We're really falling apart here. All right, we'll talk to you all next time. Follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA. I've been live tweeting all these games, even the ones involving the Raptors. And also follow Danny on Twitter at DannyLarue. And then the iTunes reviews and ratings that we've been getting have been fantastic. That helps more people learn about the show. I actually have used some of those reviews in soliciting sponsors, so we really appreciate whoever it was who said that we were the Atlantic of NBA podcasting. I really appreciated that one. That was fantastic. So thanks so much for that. Thanks so much for listening and all the support. We will be back on Sunday night after Oklahoma City and Golden State Game 3 from the great state of Oklahoma. Talk to y'all then.